You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Russia orders the withdrawal of its troops on the border with Ukraine. We'll ask why Moscow might be de-escalating its stance on the crisis in eastern Ukraine. I'll be joined by Samira Shackle and James Boyes to discuss that and more of the day's news. Also ahead, India's defeated Congress Party meets to discuss its dismal showing at the country's general election. We hear from the best-selling author William Dalrymple on the change underway in India's political makeup.
And the fact of the matter is, this man is now in charge. He will be in charge for the next 5 years. He's got an overwhelming mandate to really do what he likes. So this is, I mean, almost like a second republic moment. It's India version two.
And before the end of the program?
Health and age is fair game. It was fair game for Ronald Reagan. It's fair game for John McCain. When people came at John McCain and said, maybe he's psychologically not fit because he was a prisoner of war.
One of the most senior Republicans in the US suggests Hillary Clinton's age and health are fair game should she decide to run in the 2016 presidential election. We'll assess whether everything should be on the table for those wanting the highest political office in the world. All that, plus we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world and review the latest exhibition openings in Madrid. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here in the next hour on Midori House. But before all of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. A US grand jury has indicted five members of the Chinese military for allegedly cyber-spying on American companies in the nuclear power, metals and solar products industries. The Department of Justice said the military hackers conspired to steal information that would be useful to competitors of those companies in China, including state-owned companies there. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the espionage charges during a news conference on Monday.
The indictment alleges that these PLA officers maintained unauthorized access to victim computers to steal information from these entities that would be useful to their competitors in China, including state-owned enterprises. In some cases, they stole trade secrets that would have been particularly beneficial to Chinese companies at the time that they were stolen.
Iraq's Independent Electoral Commission has announced that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki won the largest share of Iraqi parliamentary seats in last month's national elections. The result deals a blow to Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish rivals who opposed his serving a third term. Preliminary results on Monday showed Maliki won at least 93 seats, far more than his two main Shiite rivals, the movement of Muqtada Sadr, who picked up 28 seats, and the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which won 29 seats. The Kremlin has announced that President Vladimir Putin ordered Russian forces near Ukraine back to their bases. However, NATO and the United States say they've seen no sign of a pullback and warn that Moscow has on previous occasions failed to carry out such promises. Moscow has massed tens of thousands of troops near the border regions where pro-Russian separatists have declared independent states, and Kiev and its Western allies fear they could be used to invade in support of the rebels. Ukraine holds a presidential election on Sunday, which Western countries consider a crucial event in resolving the country's crisis. The United States and EU have threatened to ramp up sanctions on Moscow if it interferes in the vote. The first defense witness has been giving evidence in the trial of the former Bosnian Serb army chief Ratko Mladic. He's accused of genocide and crimes against humanity linked to the Bosnian War of the 1990s. A second shipment of aid from the United Nations has arrived in Serbia, containing relief for those affected by the worst flooding the country has seen in decades and which has left at least 39 people dead. The resident coordinator of the United Nations in Serbia, Irena Vojakovic-Solarano, praised the government's efforts in helping those affected by the flooding, which was caused by the heaviest rainfall in the Balkans since records began 120 years ago.
The government is doing a tremendous job in coordinating all the relief that is coming in, and we are supporting them. What is now coming is to assess the damage and to assist in reconstruction. For this, OCHA from the United Nations has brought a whole team that is specialized in all areas to assess not only the damage in agriculture and industry, but also on the social and health side.
The British Royal Air Force has sent a military aeroplane to help in the international search for more than 200 kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls. US forces have already been involved in the search for the missing girls, and the British surveillance plane will join them, operating from the Ghanaian capital Accra. The head of the World Food Programme has arrived in North Korea to discuss how to keep aid flowing into the country. The UN's food agency provided more than $3 million worth of food aid for children and pregnant women in February, but continued international pressure over North Korea's nuclear programme is putting that under threat. Executive Director Ertharin Cousin is hoping to find a way around that.
I'm very hopeful that we can meet with as many officials as possible to talk about the WFP program. This is an important time for us. We find ourselves in a very difficult financial position, and we're very concerned about our ability to continue operating here without additional support from the government to ensure that we can meet the needs of those that we serve.
And that's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. And James will, of course, be back in about 20-odd minutes with a roundup of the full headlines. Stay with us. We're right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London now is 18.07, which means it's 13.07 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Samira Shackle and James Boyes. Welcome both to the programme. Well, in a development a little earlier today, Russia announced it is scaling back its military presence on the borders of Ukraine. James, let's start with you on this. Is this a meaningful event? We've heard over the last few weeks Putin say regularly that he may be pulling back troops. They still seem to be there in large numbers. And in a way, he's getting what he wants now, because it seems that arms are being run across the border. Certainly these groups in the east of Ukraine are very well armed now.
Yeah, it seems like we've been talking about this story for a very long time now. And I guess the good news is it hasn't developed to a point where we're talking about conflict and bloody civil war at this point, which can only be a good thing. The question, of course, is one of command and control. We've heard about Putin ordering these troops to be withdrawn in the past. The orders have been given. Nothing's happened. One doubts very much that someone's deciding to put their fingers in their ears and not listen to Vladimir Putin. I don't think you'd stick around very long if that were the case. So it seems to me that there is a game of sort of switch and tell going on here. Putin ordering things to happen, then them not happening, so that he can say, well, I've ordered these things to happen. One hopes that these troops will start to withdraw, and we can settle down to a more period of equilibrium in that part of the world very soon.
Samira, if the troops are pulled back, though, do you think it makes any real difference? Because as I was saying, it seems these groups are now very well armed in the east of the country. Putin's kind of got what he wants. He's got Crimea. He didn't really want to send troops into the whole of Ukraine. So do you think, in a way, he had to at some time pull back anyway?
Well, I think that certainly it would do something towards de-escalating the crisis. Certainly, at least in terms of the pressure on Kiev, basically. That I think even if there was no intention to use the troops, and I think there probably wasn't much intention by Putin to sort of invade Ukraine, that having those troops there, 40,000 people on the border, ready to go, fully armed, I think is a very, very powerful bargaining tool, a very powerful pressurizing chip. And I think that's sort of why probably we've seen him. This is now the third time he's ordered troops to withdraw, and absolutely no withdrawal. So I think if they do withdraw, even as you say, I think it's not going to mean stability in Ukraine, but I think it will sort of go some way to at least allaying fears, which are very real to lots of people in Ukraine, about an imminent invasion.
James, if you're one of these groups that's taken over a town and you've declared your republic and you thought the Russians were coming, do you begin to feel a little bit kind of queasy now?
Well, I think that if you look at the situation, there's no doubt that the Russians have made gains into the east of the Ukraine. There's certainly an imbalance in that country. We would talk about the idea of, well, you know, would he have intended to use them? I can remember being on the show just a few weeks ago and sharing the show with our former man from Belarus, who was talking quite openly about the very real risk of land war in this region. So things have thankfully scaled back from that position. But, you know, the idea of putting that many troops in close proximity to another land army is inherently dangerous. We've seen wars start that way. And the fact that Putin hopefully has stepped back is partly only part of the reason we haven't seen a flashpoint. And the other reason, of course, is that there's a lack of willingness by the West and by the Obama administration to want to get involved in that part of the world. Thank goodness.
Well, let's move to Sri Lanka now, where yesterday the country marked its victory day to mark the end of the country's brutal civil war 5 years ago. But in what some commentators claim is a troubling move, the government in Colombo has banned members of the Tamil community from building their own memorials for people who died in the conflict. Now, Samira, when I saw this, first of all, obviously your immediate thought is, yes, this is terrible. But then what's wrong is, you know, that it's the country hasn't united, that they can have a shared kind of memorial for people who are lost on both sides. What seems to be evidence from this is, yeah, actually, he may feel he's won the war, but the country remains really kind of like divided over what happened even. They can't even agree on the history. Mm.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an incredibly divided, polarized context. And it's interesting that Sri Lanka's prime minister said that it was a sort of celebration of peace. And that, I think it's quite insensitive in the context where you've just come out of a really bloody decades-long civil war to call it a victory day and not a sort of peace day, because that implies the victory of one side over the other, which of course is what happened, but that's not sort of in keeping with the stated aim of reconciliation, of unifying the country. And I think, you know, this is the fifth anniversary. In past years, both sides have sort of mourned their dead and sort of marked the day. But this particular year, I mean, that there's sort of increasing tensions over the fact that the Tamils' main political party made sort of big wins in September's provincial elections. So I think there's sort of anxiety about that, sort of keenness to sort of keep that sort of Tamil ethnic politics at bay, and I think it's quite worrying.
James, you know, I wonder whether there's a really odd thing here, a small point, but I often think that places where people go on holidays to get a better kind of like PR after these terrible events, because people want to go back on holiday. Why is it that Sri Lanka, you know, we're looking at the numbers here, perhaps 100,000 people were killed in the civil war, which lasted 26 years. People feel that the president has, you know, even Western commentators feel that there's, you know, a certain amount of murk surrounding his activities. Nobody feels that the security forces there are doing a fair and legitimate job. Why is it that Sri Lanka kind of gets away with it, do you think?
Well, one wonders. I mean, it was a setting for a lot of Duran Duran videos in the early 80s. I mean, maybe that was something to do with it. Maybe, you know, go chasing around tigers in that part of the world. But if you look, I think, at what's going on here, who am I to say about why it is that people suddenly want to go on Sri Lanka to holiday? But there's a problem here, and Samira rightly touched upon it, which is, how do you bring a nation together after an effective civil war? I mean, what's going on here, it would seem like, would be like Lincoln suddenly deciding we're going to have a parade to celebrate national unity in Atlanta, for example, after the American Civil War. You wouldn't dream of it. This idea of how you put things to rest, the leadership obviously in Sri Lanka are basically saying, well, you know, these people should celebrate, you know, the deaths of their family members on the day they died. But of course, so many people don't know the deaths the day that people died within their families, because they just disappeared. So this is not a helpful step in terms of national reconciliation with regard to Sri Lanka.
Samira, do you feel that, you know, outside forces should be encouraging a kind of greater national dialogue? We know in the past, actually, it's been quite good when other kind of foreign dignitaries have gone to Sri Lanka, you know, for Commonwealth discussions, etc. They have raised this point that there is a kind of an untold story that needs to be confronted, and they've gone to see the displaced people. But do you feel that outside forces should be doing more to encourage national dialogue?
Yeah, I think so. Within reason, I suppose. I think you can encourage, you can't necessarily force it. And I think the UN is investigating rights abuses on both sides in the civil war. I think that's probably a good thing to sort of, as you say, it's an untold story. So if that can be sort of some sort of consensus internationally, at least on what happened, at least that would be a good place to start building reconciliation. Because as you've said, you know, that they can't even agree on that. So if the story can be established, then perhaps there's some steps towards reconciliation. But I think the current Sri Lankan leadership's been quite hardline about saying we're doing enough and not being very receptive to suggestion on that.
It is strange, James, the pecking order of stories, because, you know, we're talking about Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Half a dozen people have died so far, 100,000 people here. Yet somehow, I wonder, there's just something that nags at me. Why is it that this is Sri Lanka story doesn't kind of, is it because we didn't have the footage? Is it because it went on for too long? Is it because it was, you know, the government there was successful at sealing, the military was successful at sealing off parts of the country where this kind of violence was happening?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I think it's traditional that the media like to have, stories that they've got great imagery to accompany. And if you're short of that, then it's difficult, I think, to try to explain it in very bite-sized chunks for people on just turning in to watch the breakfast news, for example. Maybe there's, I hate to say it, maybe there's a racial element with regard to this. You know, this is not a Caucasian background, for example. We're talking about a very different origin, for example. If this was happening on mainstream Europe, for example, if this was equivalent to what happened in the Balkans, for example, in the 90s, it might well have got a very different take, I think. I'm sure it's been broadcast more heavily in the subcontinent, for example, but it's certainly got less traction here in Western Europe, I'd suggest.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Samira Shackle and James Boyes. When we return, we'll ask what's next for India's defeated Congress Party and ask whether age and health should be fair game in a US presidential race. Stay with us.
As voters across Europe prepare to go to the polls in this year's EU elections, The Briefing presents a special edition live from Frankfurt. Broadcasting from the historic Stedel Museum, we'll assess what role Germany, Europe's powerhouse economy, will play on the continent following Election Day. And we'll also take an in-depth look at Frankfurt itself and ask what makes Germany's financial hub tick. From its music... to its fledgling movie industry.
Only moments ago, New York has come under attack. Witnesses claim to have seen hundreds of UFOs. It's opening fire! Oh my God!
It's a really nice city and we have almost everything. We have a skyline, we have a nice river, we have really old historic buildings and a really modern infrastructure.
That's a special edition of The Briefing live from Frankfurt on Wednesday at midday on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Samira Shackle, the journalist and commentator on Asian affairs, and the political historian Dr. James Boyes. Well, in New Delhi a little earlier today, the Congress Party, which suffered its worst general election defeat in recent memory at this year's vote, met up to unpick why they lost and what they should do next. Well, I'll put that question to both of you in a moment, Samira and James. But first, a short while ago, the best-selling author William Dalrymple gave his assessment of Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister-elect, and the country that he knows so well.
I've never met him, and in fact, very few people in Delhi have. That's one of the strange moments of Indian history, because this is, in a very real sense, a revolution, I think, because Delhi's had a very cosy political class, which have swapped between the BJP and Congress happily for the last 20, 30 years. And most people in Delhi know people from both parties, and there's that slight feeling in the very Indian way that you can sort of call on your friend in one or the other party, depending on who's in power. This is a bolt from the blue. A lot of the old BJP guard have been discarded or turfed out. Modi, who's been the king of Gujarat for 10 years now, has very few friends in Delhi. And the only big sort of party man in Delhi who everyone knew, who's Arun Jaitley, is about the only major BJP leader not to have got a seat. So no one of the old guard is going to be in a very senior position of power. Modi can really do what he likes now with India. I mean, the Indian people have made their choice, and it's been not just a wave, but a tsunami. It has swept away. And so, in a sense, it's not for me to question the choice that the country has almost unanimously made. On the positive side, Modi has an extremely good record with the economy. He has a good relationship with big business, has been fantastic at encouraging big corporate firms into Gujarat, huge car manufacturing plants and so on. On the downside, which is why so many liberals have been so anxious and so many intellectuals, he's regarded as very authoritarian. He's made life very difficult for journalists in the state and made life almost impossible for those who don't agree with him. There have been sedition charges slapped, for example, on Times of India journalists who've questioned his rule. And most
famously of all, he was in power when one of the very worst communal riots of modern history took place in 2002, when the figures are disputed, but between 1,000 and 2,000 Muslims were massacred in a particularly horrific way, chopped up and had kerosene poured over them. And at the time, many accusations were made that Modi had told the police to hold back. The Human Rights Watch report made it very clear that there was state participation in these riots. Since then, a report commissioned by the Supreme Court has cleared him, and for many Indians, that's a carte blanche now for him, and he can say he had nothing to do with it. Most intellectuals would beg to differ, and the report has been itself questioned. But the fact of the matter is, this man is now in charge. He will be in charge for the next 5 years. He's got an overwhelming mandate to really do what he likes. He hasn't quite got the mandate for massive constitutional change, but if he was to find 30 more allies, he can change the constitution. So this is, I mean, almost like a kind of second republic moment. It's India version two.
Well, that was the author William Dalrymple. I think sitting under the Air India flight path, birds also dragged into that recording there. We certainly had a very kind of live sense of being in India. Samira, let's just look at two things. So there's, first of all, the absolute rejection of Congress. Now, is this because of their utter failure with the economy? Or is it because there's a kind of more seismic shift in how people feel about being Indian and the things that they want to connect with in that country?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there's the fact that there's been an economic slowdown, that food prices have risen, all of those sort of immediate factors. But I think that what's really interesting is the sense that India's sort of moving away from the dynastic politics which have dominated so much. I mean, a lot's been made of the fact that Modi is from a low caste. He sort of once sold tea at a train station. Is it completely unthinkable for someone from that background to progress so far in India, even sort of 20, 30 years ago, I think. So that's really interesting. And I think in a way, the Congress campaign, I mean, Congress has also been rocked by a series of very damaging corruption scandals in the last parliament. So I think that there's also a sense of just sort of enough, let's have a change. But I think that the Congress campaign sort of really exemplified the worst of dynastic politics in the last parliament, in the last election campaign, sorry, because Rahul Gandhi was, he sort of came across as sort of conceited and dim at best, and at worst just with a sort of horrible sense of entitlement, absolutely no sense of being able to relate to people. I think one really bad election poster that I saw was featured him sort of smiling and very obviously photoshopped with his arm around a sort of sweeper and very different people. And I think that sort of sums up what people don't want, is someone who can't speak to them, who can't understand their concerns, is trading on the family name and the traditional respect for elites.
James, when you look at this, Sonia Gandhi and Rahul Gandhi today apparently offered their resignation from the leadership of the party, and the party turned around and said, "Please don't do that. You know, it's not your fault. It's our fault. Uh-huh. You know, don't worry about it." Is that the kind of one of the final nails, you think, in the coffin for Congress? If they can't shake themselves up and accept that there is a kind of new modernity around the corner for India?
Yeah, I think so. You know, as an Englishman, I love understatement. So when Sonia Gandhi says, "We didn't get the support we anticipated," yeah, no kidding. 44 out of 543 seats, less than 20% of the vote. You know, when you consider the dynastic quality of this party and how influential the Gandhi regime have been effectively over, you know, many, many decades, it's a remarkable sea change. I like the article in the report, you know, this is India 2.0 effectively beginning. Well, we'll have to see. What's fascinating in terms of why people voted, coming back to your earlier question, there was a suggestion, I think, that you're seeing the emergence of almost presidential style, personality-driven politics, the idea that people were voting specifically for Modi as opposed to necessarily for his party, which could have some interesting ramifications moving forward, on the basis that if you put all your eggs in one basket supporting one individual, what happens if that individual isn't around in the future? So, you know, knowing Indian politics, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the forthcoming years.
We haven't got much time left. We're going to move swiftly on. We're going to move to the US for our final discussion today, where this emerged as one of the biggest news stories from Sunday's political talk show circuit.
Health and age is fair game. It's fair game for Ronald Reagan. It's fair game for John McCain. When people came at John McCain and said maybe he's psychologically not fit because he was a prisoner of war.
Well, that was Reince Priebus there, chair of the Republican National Committee, saying that should Hillary Clinton run for the US presidency in 2016, her age and recent question marks over her health should all be on the table. His comments follow remarks made by Karl Rove, former political advisor to President George W. Bush, who made controversial statements last week that suggested Hillary Clinton's health was worse than her team were letting on. Smira, is it fair that if somebody feels, you know, the kind of leader is, the potential leader of your nation is, you know, perhaps not well, that isn't, is becomes part of the discussion?
I think there's a sort of division to be drawn between discussion of age and discussion of health. So discussion of age is something that's come up in past presidential election campaigns about Reagan, about John McCain. But discussion of health, especially in the way it was done in this instance, I feel is sort of quite below the belt. No one, you know, people might have discussed whether John McCain's age would preclude him being a good president, but I don't think anyone really suggested that the sort of injuries he sustained while fighting in the war might damage his chances. So I think there's sort of, I don't know if that's just my own squeamishness, but something about using someone's health against them seems quite nasty. And I think it's probably something that the Clinton campaign, should it happen, would be particularly sensitive to, because of sort of when she was contesting the 2008 primary, there was sort of quite a lot of fuss at that time, I remember, about sort of gendered language being used in the media, lots of talk about her cackle and her cleavage and all sorts, really. So yes, I think I don't know, but I suppose that the worry would be there's a potential for that sort of discussion of health to sort of feed into that sort of women being not fit to govern.
James, health, age, are they up for grabs?
Let's be honest about this. We're talking about Hillary Clinton as a potential presidential candidate before the midterm elections of 2014 have even taken place. That says something. It says that Hillary Clinton is the number one target for the Republican Party. They want to destroy her before she even announces for the presidency. The health of every candidate, both financial and physical, is always on the table every time there's a presidential election. Hillary will have the same opportunity to present her medical record just as everybody else does. The problem now, though, you've got is that people like Karl Rove are going around trying to plant the seed that somehow there's something wrong, that the administration isn't letting up, and this will tap into the sense of the Clintons around it again not revealing the truth. Now, every time they do this, of course, the Clintons are almost always exonerated. Hillary Clinton travelled further, more often than any other Secretary of State. She was no doubt exhausted at the end of her time in office, and had an incident which basically caused her not to be in the public eye during the last days of the Obama's first term. Undeniably true. However, does this mean, therefore, that she's got some sort of mental ailment that Karl Rove has terribly put forward? Almost certainly, absolutely not.
Well, he also kind of put that comment out there, then tried to withdraw it, pretended to try and withdraw it a bit after it had kind of done the damage.
Yeah.
On the issue of age, it doesn't have to be raised. We all kind of know how old these people are. But on the issue of health, do you think that it's up to the candidates at some point to be honest about their health? You know, if somebody's got, you know, mental health issues, which obviously she hasn't, but if they did have, or if there was something, you know, there was some kind of, you know, brain issue, is that something that in the end should come out into the public domain, do you think? Or do you think, again, even then, even when it's down to the candidate, they have the right to keep that private?
I mean, my instinct is that you should have the right to keep it private unless it's something that is going to have a very serious effect on your ability to govern, in which case it should be declared. But I think, I suppose the question is where you draw the line on that, and I'm sure James has some views on that.
I mean, my thinking on that is, to be honest, if you basically take a stance which says you've got to get everything out there, in 1960, would the Americans have elected John F. Kennedy with an adrenal deficiency? Would they have elected FDR in 1932, knowing he was polio-stricken in a wheelchair? Highly debatable, in which case you end up with Richard Nixon and a second term for Hubert Hoover. You take your chances as to which you think would be better for history.
Well, I'm afraid we were going to dive into the world of media as well today, but we had too much fun in the first half with those topics instead. So we're going to leave it there. Samira Shackle, the journalist and commentator on Asian affairs, and the political historian Dr. James Boyes, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and we're going to bring you a review of the latest art openings in Madrid. But before we get started on any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
A US grand jury has indicted five members of the Chinese military for allegedly cyber-spying on American companies in the nuclear power, metals and solar products industries. The Department of Justice said the military hackers conspired to steal information that would be useful to competitors of those companies in China, including state-owned companies there. Iraq's Independent Electoral Commission has announced that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki won the largest share of Iraqi parliamentary seats in last month's national elections. The result deals a blow to Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish rivals who opposed his serving a third term. The Kremlin has announced that President Vladimir Putin ordered Russian forces near Ukraine back to their bases. However, NATO and the United States say they have seen no sign of a pullback and warn that Moscow has on previous occasions failed to carry out such promises. The first defense witness has been giving evidence in the trial of the former Bosnian Serb army chief Ratko Mladic. He's accused of genocide and crimes against humanity linked to the Bosnian War of the 1990s. And a second shipment of aid from the United Nations has arrived in Serbia, containing relief for those affected by the worst flooding the country has seen in decades and which has left at least 39 people dead. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. And the time here in London is 18.32, which means it's 21.32 in Moscow and it's 14.32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And indeed, we're heading to Brazil and to Rio de Janeiro, where our correspondent Sheena Roster is joining us now. Sheena, nice to speak to you. Well, can I just tell you, it's really nice and sunny here in London. Toasty. How's it in Sao Paulo? Hello, Sheena.
Hello.
Hello, Sheena. Well, I was just telling.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, good. I was just telling you how nice the weather is here in Brazil. We don't normally do weather chat. How's it there? Hello. Sheena. Gentlemen, ladies, and gentlemen, we're having a slight problem with our line to Sao Paulo. So my joke isn't going down that well. So we'll come back to explain all of that though in a moment. But we're going to have a little pause while we try and get a better line.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Boulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. We're having trouble connecting to Sheena Roster in Sao Paulo, so a bit of a change of order here. Sworn virgins are the name given to women who choose to live as men in Albania. It's a way of escaping sexism in some traditional parts of the country. Author Elvira Adonis filmed a documentary about them, and now the English version of her novel, Sworn Virgins, has just been released, with a film based on the novel due for later this year. The novel tells us the story of a woman who decided to become a sworn virgin, living as a man for 14 years, but in the end, breaking her oath and moving to America to live as a woman. For more, we have Elvira Adonis in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Good. Now, you are Albanian. You know the country incredibly well. This book was written first in Italian, I believe, and has just been translated into English. Now, the thing that you're talking about isn't a kind of a made-up thing, a fiction just for your book. This is something that actually happens, has traditionally happened in Albania.
Yes. It has been a long tradition of six centuries now.
And in what circumstances does it happen?
Well, it happens when, of course, it's based on the canon, which was the set of regulations and rules that regulated that part of the northern part of Albania, where basically there was no state, there was nothing, so they regulated their economic and social life. And the woman, of course, what was put at the bottom line of the society. So the only way for a woman not to marry the man combined, given to her by the father, so as not to disobey him, was to just say, "I want to be a man. I want to help you with a house." And in this case, she avoided two things. As I said before, she didn't disobey her father. And at the second time, and the second reason is that the two families, the family of the man she was going to marry, didn't go into a blood feud, being refused, with the family of the girl.
So tell me, I understand that, you know, that they do and they did dress as a man, but they didn't take a partner, so they had to commit to celibacy as well.
Yes, they were virgins. I mean, everything happens when they are very, very, very young. Sometimes they are promised in spouses when they are in their mother's belly, so they didn't have a choice, and they found a man that was 30 years older than them, so it was their only way out, in a way. This is one of the reasons. The other reason is economical.
And just tell me, so Hannah, the kind of the lead character in your book, why did you think it was interesting to look at this as a, you know, for your character? Was it a way of looking at contemporary sexism, of, you know, the roles that we play? What attracted you to this kind of tradition to put into a modern novel?
You know, the first time I came to know about the Sworn Virgins was through an album, a family album. They were close neighbors to my parents, and they showed me this beautiful wedding. In the middle of the big clan, of this big picture, was this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful man. And I thought that was the head of the family. So I asked the neighbor, and I said, "Oh, what a beautiful man. Is he the Batsa of the family, of the clan?" Batsa is, I mean, the head of the family. And he smiled and he said, "Oh, no, she's a sworn virgin." And it just remained, it stuck in me, in a way, because I was very young at the time and I couldn't understand how can you do this in an age when you don't know what sex is, when you haven't had an experience. It remained in me, but at the time we couldn't travel Albania. It was a dictatorship. It was not like now that you can go and you can research. And later in college, I met many girls that came from the northern part of Albania. And in a way, they entered our world, but we didn't know anything about theirs.
And tell me, your hero heroine goes to America, so, and then starts to live as a woman. So for you, you know, as a woman writer, was that also, you know, here you've got this person who's kind of tried to erase who they are as a woman and put aside some of the things that made them feminine and a woman, and then she goes to America and she rediscovers those things. Was that interesting for you to think about? What is it that makes a woman? How do you become a woman? You know, are those some of the questions you try and grapple with?
The first thing, to tell you the truth, the first thing that drove me to that was their solitude. I mean, to me, being a rebel and being a young girl, to me was, what happens when you are forced to take the oath of virginity, and then perhaps you regret it, but you cannot take it back? So the first thing that drove me was the fact that how do you manage it? How do you manage it for the rest of your life? Because in the moment you have taken the oath in front of 12 men of the village, you of course had to dress as a man. You gained all the rights of a man, and you gave up the chores of a woman. So you became, you want something and you lose something for them. That was their logics.
It's also fascinating that, you know, Enver Hoxha, as you say, this dictator who was so kind of crazed that he tried to stop men having beards and doing all sorts of things. And if you wore a flare trouser, you'd go to jail. And I remember some of these crazy rules. But he couldn't stop this. This carried on then.
He ignored them. Because they were not a danger for the regime. They were confined only in the Alps of the Albania and not in the rest of the country. And some of these women, as men then, they commanded 300 men in the agricultural cooperative. So it didn't disturb them. The regime was not endangered by them.
And tell me, your novel, obviously it comes out in Albania. So do Albanians just pick it up and read it as a very normal story about a very normal thing? And then when you go abroad, you have to start explaining all this kind of unusual tradition. Does it get very different receptions at home in Albania and abroad when you travel?
Well, the book keeps selling and selling and selling and selling in Albania. But the first time when it came out, not all Albanians knew about them.
So even in Albania, it remains something of a mystery and a secret.
It was a mystery under the regime. Later it became like they dismissed the people of the cities. They dismissed these girls, these women, as something primitive without knowing the real reasons why they did that.
And tell me, what was interesting, we've had a few stories in the magazine over time about, I see the foreword in your book is written by a very famous Albanian author as well. How come Albania, this tiny country, produces so many quality writers?
Because in the Balkans you have everything. It's so intense that you have the embarrassment of the choice as regarding to stories. It has always been a very intense country with a very intense history. So you have material, you have raw material. It's so beautiful to have the material in Albania.
And I presume you were a young writer already under the time of Enver Hoxha. I don't want to be dangerous here and guess your age, but were you already writing under the dictatorship?
No.
You were too young for that?
Because if you had to write, for example, a selection of poems, 80% of them had to be about the party, the Communist Party, and how glorious the country was, and then only 20% of that was left to romantic stories. So I didn't want to give myself that kind of grief. I couldn't write what they wanted, so I expected to defect Albania and then start writing properly.
And that's what you did? You defected from the country?
Or? Yes, I defected from the country.
Because it must be very difficult to be a writer under a dictatorship and know that you have those stories within you, but to kind of decide to keep silent. To be a writer and not write, it must be a huge challenge.
But I was too young at the time. I had to grow up. I had to get another education out of Albania, because I left when the regime was still there, Enver Hoxha was dead. It was shaky at that time. So I waited for myself to get mature, to be more mature and to write other books in the meantime.
And tell me, you wrote this book, I believe, in Italian first. Why the decision to start writing Italian? I understand, again, this is another kind of thing that's been quite common for Albanian writers to write actually in Italian.
There are some of them right now, but living in the Italian-speaking section of Switzerland and working for the Swiss television, for the Swiss public television, it was the language of the family. It was the language that I used every day in my work. And after 7 books written in Albanian, it just came like this. It came in Italian. The first phrases came in Italian, the first sentences. the atmosphere came in Italian, so I took it from there.
And when you've got to know a character in a book so well, you know, such as your hero, I don't know what to call a hero, heroine at the beginning of the book, Hannah, when you then hear her speaking in English, is that unusual for you to know this person? You know this person, as you say, the first language that came to her was Italian, and you know that she would sound like an Albanian, and then in English. Does she seem like the same character across all those languages? Do you see different things in her as she's translated by different translators?
Well, I felt so comfortable with the translation of Clarissa Botsford. And since I read English, I was happy when I read the first chapters that she sent to me, and I was, wow, this sounds Albanian.
And have any of the PR people suggested you kind of pass yourself off as a gentleman for the signings of the book?
Not yet.
See, I should be your PR. I'd have you on the front pages of all the newspapers in no time. Elvira Jordanes, the author of Sworn Virgins, thank you very much for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monaco, vada se ti chei chei.
From London,
London, cara.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, a little bit earlier, we were trying to speak to Sao Paulo. We were trying to speak to Sheena Roster, and I'm reliably informed that she's actually on the line now. And Sheena, tell me what the weather's like in Sao Paulo.
Well, in Sao Paulo, they got hit quite hard yesterday with basically it was raining kind of ice, hail-like structures yesterday. And it started at about 4 p.m. local time, and it basically rained down hail for several hours, which basically created a major sheet of ice for 500 meters on several streets in one neighborhood in Sao Paulo called Aclimação. Of course, most people in the Northern Hemisphere, they would be basically, oh no, not again, this is awful weather. But here, Brazilians have quite embraced it because basically what's left on the street is a big sheet of snow. So some quite funny images have been coming out of Sao Paulo today. Namely, people getting on snowboards, getting pulled behind cars, trying to ride down the street as if it were some sort of ski resort. But of course, it's causing a lot of problems in the city because Brazil's not used to dealing with snow at all. So the question of how this is going to get removed is definitely another big issue that the city hall is going to have to deal with.
Sao Paulo and ice, that's a show I'll come and see. Now, the FIFA Secretary General has arrived in Brazil, taken up official residence, as it were, and he's readying himself for the handing over of the various stadia. Tell us how that's been taken, that news.
Yes, yeah, so basically today, Secretary General Jerome Valk basically made a blog post saying, hello, everybody, vai ter Copa Sim, which is basically, yes, there will be a World Cup. I'm here now in Brazil, and I'll be here until the day after the final, which will happen on July 13th here in Rio de Janeiro. The relationship between the Brazilian government and FIFA has been a bit rocky for the past little while, especially when Jerome Valk made a comment about a year and a half ago saying that Brazil needed a good kick up the backside due to all these delays that have been happening. Of course, things have been severely delayed here. Only yesterday did the Sao Paulo Stadium Arena Corinthians get inaugurated. That will be the first stadium that will get handed over to FIFA on May 21st here. But of course, that's well beyond the deadline, which was originally scheduled to be March 31st. So things are definitely behind schedule here, but I think basically the Brazilian government is happy that now FIFA is here to look after this stuff, because Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, said to a group of sports journalists on Thursday at a dinner at the presidential palace that she just wishes that Sepp Blatter, the president of FIFA, and Jerome Valk, the secretary general, would just get off her back. So I think Dilma is kind of getting relieved that the World Cup is now in less than 20 days and she can soon rid herself of FIFA officials.
And Valka, it sounds like he might have some other things on his plate rather than kind of worrying about the president anyway, because it seems that there's 450 cases already of trademark infringement being tackled in Brazil.
Yes, that's right. So obviously we're getting really close to the World Cup here. So a lot of street vendors are trying to profit on this as much as possible. But that has led to 450 trademark infringements. So basically, before there was this World Cup law that was implemented here in Brazil, specifically to cater to the mega sporting event that's coming up, FIFA registered over 1,100 trademarks basically just to the World Cup. So it's anything that says World Cup, anything that says Brazil 2014, or anything that actually says one of the 12 host city names with the year 2014 behind it. Vendors could be infringing on their trademark if they're not approved by FIFA to sell those merchandise. Of course, FIFA is armed to the teeth with lawyers, as you'd expect them to be, and they actually have lawyers in each of the 12 host cities here in Brazil, basically eyeing the merchandise to see if they are breaking the trademark infringement.
Well, Sheena, thank you very much for finally joining us. Not your fault, our fault, or the telecom world's fault. Let's blame somebody else for once. That was Sheena Roster, Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Well, you know what it's time for now. It's the same every day. It's culture. And the bit of culture we're getting today is from Madrid, because we're going to join Liam Aldous, our man in the city, who's going to tell us about some of the best art exhibitions happening there. Liam, thank you for coming onto the show. Oh, I apologise. I've just been told I was already waiting for it. I was about to quiz him. Apparently he has already spoken a little earlier to Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
So, Leon, I'm sure it was a lovely sunny weekend in Madrid, but instead of topping up the tan, I believe you've been to a few exhibitions for us, right? Where shall we start?
Yeah, I did go to a few, and it was great because it was the final of the football final over the weekend. A lot of the galleries were surprisingly empty, so I had them all to myself. So it was quite a luxury. But the first place I visited was the Fundación Telefónica, which is one of the newest art spaces in Madrid. It opened in 2012, and it's the Telefónica, the Grand Telecoms Foundation. And I visited this amazing exhibition by Rafael Lozano Hemmer, who's a Mexican-born artist who deals a lot with the issue of technology and how it's become such a natural part of our lives. And the exhibition only just opened on the 14th of May, and it was curated by Kathleen Ford from the Bo Russin Contemporary in Istanbul, which actually it showed there in 2013. And the exhibition itself was quite amazing because it required a lot of interaction from the visitors. And the whole concept is about how this uses the statistical analysis of biological data, and all the installations are conceptually rooted in emotionally evocative biometrics, such as the beating of the heart, the breath, our voice. And like I said, it involved a lot of participation. So I had to go in, and the first exhibit was these 100 light globes in this massive room, and you had to touch a piece of metal, and it measured your heartbeat, and then the light globe started measuring and imitating your heartbeat, and it was kind of this intimate moment suddenly, just as the light globe started imitating my heartbeat. All these people walked in. I had my heartbeat on full display. It was quite, like I said, an intimate moment.
Wow, I like that. And also, I saw on the website there's a nice picture of a close up of an eye called Surface Tension.
Yeah. There's quite a few. There's video projections. There was even an air chamber, and this was the thing that I found most interesting. It was this recycled air chamber where you go in for about 15 minutes, and apparently the air is going to be recycled over the whole 6 months that this exhibition's on display, which is kind of a little disturbing. And I asked the the woman who was kind of overseeing the installation, whether a lot of people had actually dared to go in there, because there was all these warnings saying, if you have a low immune system, don't go in, if you're claustrophobic, don't go in. And she said, well, not many people have gone in, but if you were to go in, I would go in now rather than go in a month or two from now when summer hits and a lot of sweaty people go in and people start getting the summer flu. So that was a little disturbing.
Oh, God. I'm glad you're fine. I'm glad you're fine, Leon. And also, let's move on maybe to something more conventional. An exhibition about Sidney Bogart. I mean, first of all, can you tell us a bit more about Sidney Bogart?
Well, yeah, this caught my eye. This exhibition is about Cine Bogart, which is a cinema which closed down about 13 years ago in Madrid. It's an iconic building. It's just near the Spanish Parliament. And it had a very checkered history. It's been a cinema, a theater, an erotic theater. It was a foundation for women for a while. And it just seems to have a lot of bad luck. It always seems to close down and then reopen under another name with another purpose. And so these some artists got together and have put on this exhibition called Cine Bogart, Imagining a Building. And they've done all these kind of different exhibitions and installations about their own interpretation on reimagining of the building. So it was in Centro, which is actually Madrid City Hall. Madrid City Hall underwent this massive renovation quite a few years ago. It actually cost nearly half a billion euros to renovate the palace. But part of that space now is a civic center and an art gallery. So they have these very interesting installations and exhibitions about the city. And as I walked around, I did kind of get an idea of the building and just the different ways they've reimagined it. Some of them were quite abstract. There was one artist who found a box when they toured the cinema, a box of the last film that was shown there, which was The Invisible Circus. And so she retweaked the soundtrack of that movie and created kind of a room full of the records the walls were made of the records of that soundtrack, and then I had the manipulated soundtrack playing. So like I said, some of it was quite abstract, but it was very interesting.
And if I may ask you, Leon, where was Cine Bogart in the city of Madrid?
Well, it's just in the very center, just near the Spanish Parliament, and it's right in the center. It's a beautiful building. It's got some kind of Islamic undertones in the architecture, and some of the images displayed in this exhibition show how much it's gone into disrepair. And one of the themes coming out of the exhibition is that buildings are an integral part of our cities, but they need people to endure, to survive. Without people, they fall into decay. And it's quite sad to see just in 13 years how in such bad a condition it is.
And finally, you have something interesting for us. Apparently, the Forgotten Museum of Madrid.
Well,
tell us more.
Well, yeah, I call it the Forgotten Museum of Madrid. Probably the authorities wouldn't like me to say that. It's the ABC Museum. It's a museum dedicated exclusively to illustration. I love this museum. It's actually in my new neighborhood. I've just moved house recently, and a lot of people don't know about it because it's not in the Paseo del Arte, which is where most of the art museums are in Madrid. But it has about 200,000 pieces of illustration, most of which were from the archives of the ABC newspaper. And what's so interesting about the permanent collection is that it shows the history of illustration, but also the history of politics of the newspaper over the last century, particularly because the newspaper was, before the Civil War, was more of a red newspaper, as they call it here. And then after Madrid fell, after the Civil War and the dictatorship came into place, well, it became a very conservative paper. So you see the kind of the evolution of the narrative in the illustrations, how they're very anti-fascist and a lot of the political cartoons, and then suddenly it changes and you see a completely different narrative line. It's so interesting, and it's especially the evolution of style as well. It's quite beautiful.
Well, that's all we have for today's Midori House. My thanks to our special guests Samira Shackle and James Boyce. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alex May. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye. Thank you for listening and tune in tomorrow.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.